Sir Samuel Luke was appointed governor, and the fortress remained in parliamentary hands for the remainder of the war. So as a mere lad, although certainly able-bodied, John Bunyan found himself a soldier or sentinel in the new model army commanded by Sir Thomas Fairfax, Black Tom, as his troops loved to call him. Early biographers of Bunyan were concerned with the possibility that John served in the Royalist ranks in the Civil War. J.A. Froude gave it as his opinion that Bunyan was a Royalist because his father was, and because John Gifford, later minister at Bedford, had been a Royalist major. The reasoning is absurd. John Bunyan was not in sympathy with his father at the time he entered the army. Bedfordshire was a parliamentary county on whom levies of conscripts were made, while John did not meet Gifford until years after the Civil War. Had Bunyan been on the Royalists' side, it is certain that his imprisonment would have been vastly different, if not avoided altogether. But the side on which Bunyan fought has been put beyond all doubt by the discovery at the record office of the muster rolls of the Newport garrison from 1644 to 1647. On November 30, 1644, John Bunyan was a private, or as it was then termed, a sentinel, in the company commanded by Colonel Richard Cockayne. On March 22, 1645, he appears in the list of Major Bulton's company, and he was regularly mustered in the Major's company up to May 27, 1645. His presence at Newport Pagnell on May 27, 1645 renders impossible the theory that he was present at the siege of Leicester, and Bunyan was still a member of one of the companies making up the force at the Newport garrison as late as June 17, 1647. Colonel Richard Cockayne, under whom Bunyan served, was a Bedfordshire man of some note, who may well have known the Bunyan family. John Bunyan served in the parliamentary ranks not for a few months, as so many writers have affirmed, but for almost 3 years. This is a considerable period in the most impressionable part of a young man's life. The officers under whom John and his fellow recruits served were often bearded, relatively well-dressed, with high-plumed hats, armored breastplates, knee breeches, and high leather boots. When the new model army was complete in 1645, Cromwell's officers were supplied with red coats, and uniforms became part of the common soldiers' equipment. John's own uniform consisted of a plain brown doublet and coat or cassock, short breeches, two shirts, stockings of good Welsh cotton, and shoes tied with laces. He also wore a Monmouth cap, knitted, blocked, and tasseled. His weapon was a short musket, presuming that he was a musketeer, though it is possible that he was a pikeman. The bullets were quite heavy, and with 12 charges of powder, were fastened in a leather bandolier worn over his shoulder and fitted with small pouches. The infantryman was paid at the rate of 8 pence a day, the cavalry trooper 3 times as much. If John was a pikeman, he would have worn helmet, breast and back plates, and metal thigh guards. The pike was 16 feet in length, but it was quite common for the soldiers to reduce the length to make it less unwieldy. The pikemen were chosen from the strongest and tallest men in the unit, and it is on account of this that some suppose John to have been a pikeman. At the same time, at 15 and a half years, he was not likely to be very tall. At Newport Pagnell, Sir Samuel Luke, the governor, an ardent Presbyterian, a valiant, energetic officer, and a man of sense and courage, lived in a house on the green, but used as his military headquarters, the Saracen's Head. John was probably billeted in a house, or he may have lived in a tent, at least in the summer. If billeted with a family, he would doubtless have made friends there, and this may account for certain circumstances to be discussed later. Much of his time would be occupied with drill. The musket, if Bunyan was a musketeer and not a pikeman, and there were two musketeers to every pikeman, was cumbersome, and, if not carefully handled, was almost as dangerous to the owner as to the enemy. It had an overall length of about 5 feet, and firing a 1¼-ounce bullet was effective at 100 yards. Because of the length and weight of the musket, it required a rest which was spiked at one end for fixing in the ground, and forked at the other end to take the musket's weight. The battle formation for the foot soldiers was usually 6 or 4 deep, each rank firing and then falling back to the rear to reload. Pike drill was basically more simple than musket drill and depended for its effectiveness on numbers. To produce the hedgehog front to charging horse and to provide a tightly knit mass of pike and armor for push of pike, a small sword called a hanger was also carried by the foot soldiers. Discipline in the new model army was strict and well supervised. To Oliver Cromwell, it was a new kind of recruitment to raise such men as had the fear of God before them and made some conscience of what they did. With so many religious men in its ranks, Presbyterians, Independents, and others, the officers and leaders of the regiments and companies were chosen for their moral character and principles as well as for their fighting abilities. The officers were concerned with the moral and religious lives of their men, as well as with their effectiveness in battle. In May 1643, Oliver wrote of his men, "No man swears, but he pays his 12 pence. If he is in drink, he is set in the sticks, or worse. If one calls the other roundhead, he is cashiered, insomuch that the countries where they come leap for joy of them." Offenses against persons and property were severely punished. The actual military discipline was also severe. In April 1643, Cromwell had 2 troopers who had deserted whipped in the marketplace of Huntingdon and then turned off as renegades. One wonders how often John Bunyan was fined for swearing. Vera Brittain, whose book, In the Steps of John Bunyan, is both a comprehensive and percipient account of John, thinks that too many biographers present a lusty young tinker and reprobate as the incarnation of moral purity. She points out that, although in Grace Abounding, paragraph 315, he definitely asserted that he was not guilty of adultery and fornication, yet in paragraphs 8 and 9, he clearly states his acquaintance with carnal sin. "Until I came to the state of marriage," he says, "I was the very ringleader of all the youth that kept me company in all manner of vice and ungodliness." She suggests also that there were brothels in Newport Pagnell. This is extremely unlikely, as such would not have been tolerated by the parliamentary authorities, though they were all too common where the royalists were in power. In a later chapter, we shall examine Bunyan's opinion of himself in his famous autobiography, but the severe discipline in the parliamentary army would argue against his early indulgence in the lusts of the flesh. Godly officers superintended the habits of those under their command. Further, at Newport Pagnell, there was constant preaching in the parish church by Independent and other preachers, and Bunyan would soon become acquainted with the main points of Puritan theology, which laid great emphasis on holiness. serious discussions and debates were often held between those of differing views on the doctrines of Scripture and the best form of church government and the conduct of the state. One can imagine John Bunyan taking a curious interest in them. That these spiritual exercises did not convert him may surprise us, but until God made John's heart ready to receive him, he was indifferent to spiritual things. The parliamentary authorities made an effort to provide for the spiritual welfare of their soldiers. There were chaplains to regiments. In October 1644, Sir Samuel Luke mentioned that there were no fewer than 7 able divines in the garrison at Newport Pagnell. 2 sermons were preached to the troops every Sabbath, and 1 every Thursday, while prayers, with the reading of a chapter from the Bible, were held every morning before the placing of the guards. No soldier was allowed out of his billet after 9 o'clock at night. A strongly religious atmosphere permeated the parliamentary ranks. Fast days and days of humiliation were kept at intervals. Whenever possible, battles were preceded by some form of religious services. After Naseby and Marston Moor, the victorious parliamentary forces sang a psalm of thanksgiving and held a solemn celebration the following Sunday. There were between 7,000 and 8,000 men in the garrison at Newport, many like Bunyan, young conscripts. Inevitably, they unconsciously absorbed democratic opinions and the religious fervor of the army chaplains and the preaching colonels. Each parliamentary soldier was issued with a copy of the Soldier's Pocket Bible, consisting of extracts from the Geneva Bible. It had the imprimatur of Edmund Calamy, an eminent Puritan, and was arranged under such headings as "A soldier must not do wickedly," "A soldier must be valiant for God's cause," "A soldier must love his enemies as they are his enemies, and hate them as they are God's enemies." "A soldier must cry unto God in his heart in the very instant of battle." The Pocket Bible, it was stated, may be also useful for any Christian to meditate upon now in this miserable time of war. John would also have a copy of the Soldier's Catechism composed for the Parliamentary Army by Robert Ram, Minister of Spalding. It was written for the encouragement and instruction of all that have taken up arms in this cause of God and his people, especially the common soldiers. It answered in a fashion satisfactory to the parliamentary side such questions as, "Is it not against the king that you fight in this cause?" The answer is, "No, surely. We take up arms against the enemies of Jesus Christ, who in his majesty's name make war against the church and people of God." Parliamentary propaganda was certainly not neglected. Oliver Cromwell's second son, Captain Oliver Cromwell, age 21, was in the garrison force at Newport Pagnell, but John Bunyan missed contact with him, for in March 1644, Oliver's son died of smallpox at Newport. He was described in a newspaper of the time as "a civil young gentleman and the joy of his father." It is not known where he is buried or whether his father attended the funeral, but when Bunyan arrived there in the autumn, he was to see the great parliamentary commander and later Lord Protector Oliver himself, for Oliver was at Newport Pagnell some time before the Battle of Naseby and inspected the troops and garrison defenses. Standing among them as they were drawn up in rank, John Bunyan saw Oliver and his staff officers, and must have been impressed by the Protector's determined look and noble bearing. It is not impossible that John was one of those appointed to mount guard over Oliver's quarters while he was in the town. As to what active military service he saw in the field, we know little. Small companies of soldiers chosen by lot were sometimes sent by the governor on marauding expeditions to seize horses or food, or to besiege castles and manors belonging to royalists in the neighborhood. On one occasion, John had an escape, he recorded, in Grace Abounding 20 years later. When I was a soldier, I with others were drawn out to go to such a place to besiege it. But when I was just ready to go, one of the company desired to go in my room, to which, when I had consented, he took my place. And coming to the siege, as he stood sentinel, he was shot into the head with a musket bullet, and he died. The use of the word siege in this passage has persuaded some biographers to suppose that Bunyan was present at the siege of Leicester, but Charles I began the investment of that town on May 28, 1645, and we know that John was at Newport Pagnell on May 27th. He could not, therefore, have been at Leicester. The reference in his autobiography must refer to the siege of a fortified house somewhere in the vicinity of the garrison town. It is most tantalizing that this is the only reference to active service during the whole 3 years he was in the army. A friend of the writer served during the Second World War in the Burma campaign, ending with the rank of colonel. He went through the whole campaign with all its horrors, disasters, and sufferings. When he left the army, he was converted and became active in Christian work, just as John Bunyan was to do. But of all he saw and experienced in Burma, he could not be persuaded to say one single word. Perhaps the suffering and horrors were too deeply etched on his memory, or he had been forced to do things which he later saw were inconsistent with his Christian profession. Surely this was the exact condition of John Bunyan. Looking back on his army career, hearing the cries and noise of battle and siege, remembering his share in it, insignificant though it may have been, remembering comrades who had been killed or wounded, he kept it all locked up in his memory and wrote barely a sentence of it all. This, in part, may well have contributed to his tumult of conscience in later days. References are made in the Holy War, 1682, to marches, war plans, sieges, and parleys, but all too vague to connect with any soldiering Bunyan may have done. All we can be certain of is that he acquired some general military knowledge. One possibility is likely, however, and that is that Bunyan was present at the Battle of Naseby on June 14, 1645, when the Parliamentary army under Fairfax and Cromwell overwhelmed and destroyed the royalists. It was a decisive victory, since it put an end to Charles's main field force. It is known that several regiments from Newport Pagnell were at Naseby under Fairfax, and it is not improbable that Bunyan was among them, but he gives us no word. At Newport Pagnell, John Bunyan became acquainted with three persons, who in years to come he was to know well, for they became his lifelong friends. We shall consider their relationship to him in due course, but here we will just note their names and occupations. The Reverend John Gibbs was appointed vicar of Newport Pagnell in 1646, replacing an adherent to the old ecclesiastical regime. He was the son of a cooper at Bedford and a student of Sidney Sussex College, Cambridge, a Puritan foundation where Cromwell had been a student. In days to come, he was to give Bunyan considerable help and to be helped by him. At Newport Pagnell also lived Matthias Cowley, who seems to have kept a stationer's or bookseller's shop, and whom Bunyan got to know extremely well. It has been suggested that it was in his shop that John first read Milton's Paradise Lost. As a soldier, Bunyan had no idea that one day he would become a celebrated author, and neither did Cowley, yet in days to come he would publish several of John's writings. Then there was William Dell, one of the Puritan chaplains to the garrison. He had trained for the ministry at Emmanuel College, Cambridge, foster mother of so many Puritan divines. He was a famous preacher. When he preached in an orchard before Sir Samuel Luke's tent, Hundreds of soldiers crowded to hear him, some even climbing the trees to do so. "There hath been," he declared, "a very sensible presence of God with us. We have seen his goings and observed his very footsteps, for he hath dwelt among us and marched at the head of us step by step." Dell was high in favor with the parliamentary leaders, and in June 1646 officiated at the wedding of Cromwell's daughter Bridget to General Ireton. John's friendship with this remarkable man lay many years ahead, but they were destined to be associated in gospel preaching in close and harmonious fellowship. So we have but glimpses of John, soldiering at Newport, growing up robust, strong-willed, excitable, noting with his keen brain all the practical side of military practice and maneuvers, and storing up details that he was to use in the Holy War. On June 26, 1645, after the Battle of Naseby, Sir Samuel Lukes's governorship of the garrison ended, owing to the passing by the Commons of the self-denying ordinance by which members of Parliament undertook to resign all military commands. He continued to represent Bedford for some years, but retired before the Restoration and died in 1670. John Bunyan and his fellow soldiers found themselves under a new governor, Captain Charles de Oily, recommended by Sir Thomas Fairfax. Soon afterwards, the garrison was reduced to 800 foot and 120 horse. During the autumn and winter of 1645 through 46, the soldiers had little to do, though regular drill and preaching went on. Two rivers met at Newport Pagnell, the Ouse and the Lovat, and no doubt John, who was a keen angler, joined with many men to fish the waters. Then on August 6, 1646, surprising news reached Newport Bagnell. Because of the decline of the king's cause, several garrisons were to be abandoned, and the soldiers employed for service in Ireland for the relief of Protestants. The garrisons of Cambridge, Huntingdon, Bedford, and Newport Pagnell were thereupon relinquished, and the Committee for Irish Affairs of both Houses of Parliament ordered the army at Newport Pagnell to be sent to Chester. John Bunyan, by now happily adjusted to military life, was in no great hurry to return to Elstow, to his royalist father and unknown stepmother. So he volunteered for Ireland and was put into Colonel Robert Hammond's regiment, his company commander being Captain Charles O'Hara. Robert Hammond was a kinsman of Oliver Cromwell, soon to be appointed governor of Carisbrook Castle on the Isle of Wight, where Charles I was to be confined at the pleasure of Parliament in 1647. John, however, was not to see the Emerald Isle. Hammond's regiment, including John, duly marched to Chester on March 1647, in advance of the main body. Here John saw mountains high and foreboding, such as he had never seen in the flat countryside of Bedfordshire. At Chester, the regiment was recalled to army headquarters at Saffron Walden and was soon to be moved to St. Albans. At Saffron Walden, the majority of soldiers refused to serve in Ireland, their objections being put to the army command by democratic representatives from each regiment. But a minority of 6 officers and 400 men were willing to go to Ireland. Among these was Sentinel John Bunyan, who under Captain O'Hara, along with the others, was marched back to Newport Pagnell to await fresh orders. Thus John's name appears on the muster roll of O'Hara's company on 17th June 1647. The journey to Ireland was eventually cancelled, and John's regiment was disbanded late in July 1647. He had thus been almost 3 years a soldier in the parliamentary army, had seen and learned much, and was now a tinker again. He reached the cottage at Harrowden soon after Bedford and District had become the headquarters of Fairfax's forces. Some 20,000 men were encamped in the surrounding area, while Fairfax, Cromwell, and Ireton were in constant discussion over negotiations with the king, which unfortunately came to nothing. The king was a prisoner, and militant Puritanism was in power. But John thought little of these matters. He was a civilian again, about to take up work on his own, and even more momentous for him, to get married. Chapter 4. Troubled Tinker. Life as a soldier had been singularly carefree. Taking up civilian life again brought many trials, anxieties, and conflicts of conscience. He had left home a boy. He returned a man. We do not know how he was received at the cottage in the fields, but very probably he was warmly welcomed, especially as Thomas now had an additional helper at the forge and on his daily rounds. Thomas had written to his son at Newport Pagnell several times, giving him the local news, such as the visit of Oliver Cromwell with 600 horse to Bedford in June 1645, and how in August the king himself with 300 royalist horse had plundered the village of Goldington, and how Charles had entered Bedford only to be driven off by Lieutenant Colonel Richard Coikane, who fought a brilliant rearguard action at Bedford Bridge. Family news had been sent, too, such as the death of John's half-brother Charles in May 1645, and the birth of another brother, Thomas, a year later. Events in the nation seemed to go from bad to worse. The parliamentary party was almost fiercely divided. The Presbyterians, in league with the Scots, demanding uniformity of worship on the Geneva model, and the independents, especially those in the army where they were in a majority, seeking toleration and freedom of conscience and the setting up of independent churches on congregational lines. Both sections were endeavoring to come to terms with Charles, who played off one against the other. It was a sad day for England when the Commons lost Hampden and Pym, wise and constructive statesmen who might well have resolved matters with a constitutional monarchy, if this had been brought about, and it is not certain that it could have been, for Charles was a most tricky and unreliable monarch. The Puritans would have been spared persecution and John Bunyan his 12 years imprisonment. He did not spend overmuch time puzzling over national events. To begin with, he flung himself into his father's work. The old skill soon returned, and soon also his 7-year apprenticeship to his father was completed, and he himself recognized and accepted as a fully trained brazier under the statute of apprentices. His stepmother and her children doubtless made the cottage a happy home, but increasingly John felt that he did not belong to it and constantly thought of seeking a home of his own. He was 19 years of age. To set himself up as an independent tinker or brazier, Bunyan had to make or acquire the tools required for his trade. No doubt with the approval and help of his father, John acquired a hammer, soldering iron, a pair of pliers, snippers for cutting tin, and a round head for shaping the lids of kettles and saucepans. Most important and more costly was an anvil, and John decided that he would forge this heavy instrument himself, with the help of a Bedford molder whom he knew. It had a spear point to hold it firm in a metal or wooden base, and when it was finished, it weighed 60 pounds. When it was completed, he carved his name on it, J. Bunyan, and on the other side, the date, 1647, and the word Helstow. In 1905, this very anvil was discovered in a marine store in St. Neots, where it had lain for 40 years. Its history was carefully traced back through a number of owners, and ultimately it is alleged to an Elstow innkeeper who took the anvil and some other tools from John Bunyan to pay a debt. There is some doubt about the latter part of this story, but that the anvil was actually John Bunyan's, there is no doubt. The signature has been compared to other Bunyan signatures known to be genuine, and the U in Bunyan agrees with the same letter in John's copy of Fox's Book of Martyrs. Other experts have examined the anvil and declare it to be of 17th century workmanship. It is now one of the most prized Bunyan relics at the Bunyan meeting in Mill Street, Bedford. The shock of horror that swept through England at the trial and execution of Charles I on January 30, 1649, reached Elstow also, but we have no means of knowing how John reacted to it. He was busy with his work, perhaps preparing for marriage, or even enjoying married life, for he married in 1648 or 1649. We have no knowledge of the date, or the church where he was married, or even the name of his first wife. All he tells us in Grace Abounding, paragraph 15, is, "Presently after this, I changed my condition into a married state, and my mercy was to light upon a wife whose father was counted godly. This woman and I, though we came together as poor might be, not having so much household stuff as a dish or spoon betwixt us both." There is no registration of this marriage in any of the parish registers of Elstow, Bedford, or neighboring places. Because of the Civil War, registers were not scrupulously kept and were sometimes destroyed. When in 1645 Parliament dissolved the established church as it had previously existed, marriages were allowed to be made before a magistrate, whose records also were often carelessly kept, lost, or destroyed. Bunyan's wife may have been a childhood friend from Elstow, or someone he had met at Bedford, but it is equally possible, and much more likely, that John met her at Newport Pagnell when he was a soldier. She may well have been a relation or friend of John's bookseller friend, Matthias Cowley. She may have been a member of the family with which John was billeted. We do not even know her name, but from the fact that often in those days the firstborn daughter was called after her mother, and John's elder daughter was called Mary, his first wife might well have been Mary. Of her surname we have no knowledge. She would appear to have been an orphan. Strange as it may seem, she was never a member of the Bedford Puritan Church, but appears to have remained an Anglican. John and Mary Bunyan, if Mary was indeed her name, rented a small cottage in the main street of Elstow Village. It had a lean-to shack at one side, which he used as a workshop, and a small garden behind, where they probably kept a few chickens. It was cheaply built of timber and pebble stone, and here John found a home brightened by peace and love. Somehow they managed to get some furniture and household things together from the gifts of friends, well-wishers among his customers, and his own earnings. The cottage pointed out to visitors to Elstow as the one in which John lived is certainly not in the same condition as it was in Bunyan's day, for it has plainly been rebuilt, has a tiled roof, whereas Bunyan's cottage was thatched, and the lean-to forge has gone. But it is probably not the original Bunyan cottage at all, for James Copner, vicar of Elstow for many years and a local antiquarian, says that Bunyan's cottage was demolished about 1836 and another built on its site. There was no imprudence in this early marriage, comments Robert Southey, not because John had a trade to support them, but because the girl had been trained up in the way she should go. She certainly had, and Bunyan himself describes this as a mercy. She was gentle, affectionate, and religious. Her father was an Anglican Puritan. "She would be often telling me," says Bunyan in Grace Abounding, "what a godly man her father was, and how he would reprove and correct vice, both in his house and amongst his neighbors. What a strict and holy life he lived in his day, both in word and deed." His wife's reminiscences had some spiritual effect on John and made him a more regular church goer. Mary's dowry consisted of two devotional books left her by her father. The first was The Plain Man's Pathway to Heaven, published in 1601 by Arthur Dent, the parish minister of Shoebury in Essex. It was really a sermon on repentance and had reached its 24th edition by 1637. In an introduction, Puritan Dent assured his readers that his book did not meddle with church controversies, but only entered on a controversy with Satan and sin. It was a book of 423 pages and was in the form of a conversation between Theologus, a divine, Philagathus, an honest man, a Sunitas, an ignorant man, and Antiligon, a cavalier. Such topics as original sin, worldly corruption, salvation, and damnation were discussed with light and heat. It made some impression upon John when he first read it, and 30 years later, when he was writing The Life and Death of Mr. Badman, he used the dialogue technique of Arthur Dent. The second book that Mary Bunyan possessed was The Practice of Piety, also very popular in its day, especially amongst Puritans. It was published in 1612 by Lewis Bailey of Evesham, afterwards Bishop of Bangor. It was written for the purpose of directing a Christian how to walk, that he may please God. James Fraser of Bree, the minister of Culross and a notable Scottish Presbyterian leader, was converted through reading it. The book consisted of meditations on the essence and attributes of God out of the Holy Scriptures. These two books John and his Mary read together in the evening after the toil of the day was done, and he says that, though they did not reach my heart to awaken it about my sad and sinful state, yet they did beget within me some desires after religion, so that, because I knew no better, I fell in very eagerly with the religion of the times, to wit, to go to church twice a day, and there should very devoutly both say and sing as others did, yet retaining my wicked life. The vicar of Elstow was Christopher Hall, who was appointed in 1639 by Archbishop Laud, but managed to hold his appointment through the civil wars, the Commonwealth, and the Protectorate, thanks in part to Cromwell's flexible ecclesiastical policy. The truth was that, although hardly a strict Puritan, he held some of their views in a moderate way, was a supporter of the parliamentary side in the war, and yet seems to have continued to use the proscribed prayer book, or parts of it, at his services. When the Restoration came in 1660, he was allowed to continue in his post. It is difficult to judge whether he was a man of courageous principle or a Mr. Facing Both Ways, but on the whole, he would appear to have been the former. To this good man and his services and sermons, John Bunyan began constantly to resort, sitting beside Mary on the unvarnished bench near the high oak-carved pulpit still to be seen in Elstow Church. Bunyan tells us that in his attendance at the parish church, he was so overrun with the spirit of superstition that I adored, and that with great devotion, even all things, both the high place, priest, clerk, vestment, service, and what else belonging to the church, counting all things holy that were therein contained, and especially the priest and clerk most happy, and without doubt greatly blessed. It is surprising to see the liturgical service and vestments continued when Parliament had supposedly suppressed them, and when anything savoring of episcopacy would have secured the ejection of the vicar. But Christopher Hall was attached to the liturgy and did not abandon the vestments. He was allowed to continue the use of these, no doubt, because he was a supporter of the Parliament, and also because Elstow was but a small and obscure place. As to what John means by retaining my wicked life, it is not easy to come to a perfectly satisfying conclusion. It appears that he was a leader of the youth in Elstow, and may even have been a popular hero because of his army experience. No doubt he embroidered many tales of adventures and horrors to eager listeners. It was my delight, he records, to be taken captive by the devil at his will, being filled with all unrighteousness, that from a child I had but few equals both for cursing, swearing, lying, and blaspheming the holy name of God. Again, I did still let loose the reins to my lust, and delighted in all transgression against the law of God, so that, until I came to the state of marriage, I was the very ringleader of all the youth that kept me company in all manner of vice and ungodliness. Yes, such prevalency had the lusts and fruits of the flesh in this poor soul of mine, that had not a miracle of precious grace prevented, I had not only perished by the stroke of eternal justice, but had also laid myself open even to the stroke of those laws which bring some to disgrace and open shame before the face of the world. He tells us also of his prowess in bell ringing and various sports. One day, he says, as he was standing at a neighbor's shop window, cursing and swearing and playing the madman after my wonted manner, the woman of the house, who was a very loose and ungodly wretch, came out and reproved him and told him that he was likely to spoil all the youth of the town. This shamed him and made him wish that his father had not given him such a bad example in this way. Strangely enough, he immediately left off swearing and could speak better and with more pleasantness than ever I could before. His vocabulary was enlarged and purified. Probably it is best not to imagine that Bunyan's early years of manhood were spent in extreme profligacy. It must be remembered that the Puritans were great soul-searchers and delighted to keep close accounts with God, their consciences accusing them severely for the least departure from the straight and narrow way. In October 1638, Oliver Cromwell wrote to his cousin, Mrs. Oliver St. John, "The Lord accept me in his Son, and give me to walk in the light as he is the light. He it is that enlighteneth our blackness, our darkness. I dare not say he hideth his face from me. He giveth me to see light in his light. Blessed be his name, for shining upon so dark a heart as mine. You know what my manner of life hath been. Oh, I lived in and loved darkness, and hated light. I was a chief, the chief of sinners. This is true. I hated godliness, yet God had mercy on me." This is a typical Puritan statement of a man who regarded his sins as more heinous than others would. It may equally have been so with John Bunyan, whose worst faults were no doubt swearing, lying, drinking, gambling, and Sunday sports. And, of course, these would appear in darker colors after his conversion. Although Christopher Hall had been appointed to his parish by Loud, he did not follow that unfortunate cleric's book of sports, so hated by the Puritans. Indeed, one Sunday, the vicar preached a powerful sermon against Sunday sports, no doubt going into details about them and the vile influence they would have on the spiritual life. To John, a great lover of the parson's sermons, this was a blow indeed. He went home conscience-stricken, thinking that Hall had preached the sermon on purpose to show me my evil doing. And perhaps he had.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."